Let me start from right away at the beginning of the Sefer. It says, Vayero Elov Hashem Be'ilone Mamre. Rashi brings down a Chazal that why did God appear to Avraham in the Elone Mamre, in this orchard of Mamre? Mamre was one of Avraham Avinu's compatriots. Onur, Eshkol, and Mamre. They went with him to fight to bring Lot back. And Mamre, Rashi says, Shenosan lo eitza al hamila. He gave him good advice about the bris milah. So the obvious question is, Avraham Avinu had to ask advice, what, whether he should listen to what God said or not. What was the advice? What did he need advice for? And if he's asking advice already, he had a Talmud called Eliezer. Why didn't he ask him? There was a Rosh Yeshiva called Shem and Aver. Why didn't he ask them? He has to go ask his Goyish, a friend of his, advice, Mamre. So I saw somebody says that it's, you have to read it differently. The Gemara says in Shabbos that there is a drug that they put on the Makom Hamila in order to stop the bleeding. And that drug is called Otze. So they say that that's what Rashi means. Hu shenosan lo otze al hamila. He gave him this drug so he could stop the bleeding by his bris milah. It's very nice, but the Medrash doesn't say that. The Medrash says very clearly that Avraham Avinu, when he got the mitzvah of bris milah, went to ask his three friends, Onur, Eshkol, and Mamre, advice. He went to Onur, the Medrash says, and he asked him what he think. And Onur told him that he thinks bad idea. You're 99 years old. This operation is going to be terminal for you. You're not going to survive it. So obviously he was telling him not a good idea to do it. He left him. He went to Eshkol. Eshkol said, look, even if you survive this operation, you just vanquished four kings who vanquished five kings to save your nephew. The relatives of those kings are just raring to take revenge. And if you're going to put yourself in a situation with your whole household of being after bris milah, you're going to be vulnerable to an attack. Just like later on, that's what Shimon and Levi did to the city of Shechem. So, also, seemingly not a good idea. He went to his friend Mamre, and Mamre told him, look, God saved you from the fiery furnace. He gave you the power to vanquish the four kings. God has a good track record with you. I would trust him that you're not going to die from this operation, and you're not going to come to harm by the relatives of the people that you killed. Do what God said. So since Mamre gave him good advice, God appeared to him in Mamre's portion. A few questions. Again, he has to ask advice from these three goyim. There's no better to ask advice from? First question. Second question. Two out of three told him not to do it. You ask advice already, listen to the advice. Don't shop around until you get the answer that you want to hear. Yeah, whatever. And if he wasn't going to listen to them, then why did he ask them? And thirdly, what was the reward that Mamre got that God appeared in his portion? Onur and Eshkol should have been punished for telling him not to listen to God. Not Mamre should have been rewarded. Why weren't they punished? For giving him bad advice. To answer all of this, start with a chazal and discuss a little bit the concept of giving advice. The Pasuk says, Nase Adam Bitzalmeinu, let us make man. When it came to create man, it says in the plural, God said, let us make man. So Chazal say, why the plural? Because before God created man, he asked advice from the angels. Should he create man or not? He asked advice. And in order to teach us, obviously God didn't need any advice from anybody, but he wanted to teach us that you should ask advice, even a greater person from a lesser person. Right? There's nobody lesser than any human being than the angels are from God. And yet God said, I'm going to ask them advice. So you also ask advice even from a lesser person. Now, on the surface, that doesn't make too much sense. Because if you're on a lower level than me and don't know as much as me, why would I, if I don't know, how are you going to know? Right? It seems very condescending. If it's, you don't like to give some honor to the person, to ask them advice, if I don't know, I know that these people don't know, but I'm asking them anyway, it's very demeaning. Right? I mean, if I look at my car motor, and I know something about engines, and I hear this noise, and I'm not sure where it's coming from, and I say to my wife, what do you think? Right? What do you think where that noise is coming from? Baruch Hashem, she knows which side of the car the engine is on. But more than that, probably too not, too much not. So what's she going to feel? That I'm making fun of her. If I don't know what it is, how in the world is she going to know? So what's the purpose of asking advice from somebody who is lower than you, who knows less than you, who's on a lower level? What's the purpose of it? If that's what God wanted to teach us. The answer is that advice, most of the time, is not to find out information you don't know. That's not the reason to ask advice. The Meiri says people are biased. When you have an issue that you have to make a decision on, so deep down, you know what you would like the decision to be. That's not always what's the best thing to do or the proper thing to do, whatever, but that's what you'd like. That's what your desires are pushing you. Okay, but you still feel that you want to be honest with yourself and really make a proper decision. So you investigate all of the different possibilities and options and come to a decision. And you think you've come to a decision that is really a fair and proper decision. What's really happened? Since you really want one way, so your Yetzer Hara blinds your eyes from seeing anything positive about the options you don't want, and to see what you do want in the rosiest terms, and you think, therefore, that you've investigated the thing and you've come to a conclusion. You really didn't come to a conclusion after investigation. What you did was make yourself feel good that you think you came to a decision that is objective when it's really subjective. Therefore, it's a good idea to ask advice from other people who are not biased, who don't have your bias, and can look at things objectively, and they will point out to you all of the criteria. They'll show you the pros and cons of the solutions you don't want and the pros and cons of the solution you do. And then you can really make a objective and intelligent decision. So the purpose of asking advice is not so much to get information. It's to get an objective view of what you don't see objectively in order to be able to deliberate it properly. In that respect, I once wanted to explain, it says that the physical organs have spiritual counterparts. And the various spiritual counterparts of the physical organs are the source of various emotions and things like that. The heart is the seat of emotional things. It's not that the heart muscle has these feelings. It's a spiritual counterpart to the heart. The spiritual counterpart to the part of the body that is involved in making decisions and getting advice, inner advice, how to make decisions is the kleios, the kidneys. Kleios yoatzos. That's why you have two kidneys. One on the left, one on the right, right? One gives you the negative side, one gives you the positive side, and that's how you make decisions. Now, the kidneys are there to basically filter the liquids in the body, right? That's the physical. But the spiritual counterpart to the kidney is the source of advice, of how a person comes to decisions and advises himself. There's a pasuk in Mishlei that says the following. Mayim Amukim Eitz of Levish. The advice in a person's heart is like deep water. The Ish Chacham Kidlen, and a wise person will be able to draw out that those deep waters. I was thinking that if you look at the physical function of the kidneys, it parallels spiritually the function of advice. The kidneys take pure water, basically, but that is mixed with a lot of poisons and filters out the poisons and leaves the pure water in the body. So if initially it says that etza, that advice, is like pure water, but the pure water is contaminated with all of your desires, what you want to see. So the kidneys, the spiritual kidneys, take out those poisons, those pollutants, and leave you with the clear water of the advice. So they have the same exact function of what the physical kidneys do is what the spiritual kidneys do. What?
Could you repeat that sentence, that quote?
Which quote? Kloios Yoatzos? Yeah, Kloios Yoatzos. What? The pasuk. Oh, Mayim Amukim Eitzo Belevish, the Ish Tivunos Yidleno. Tivunos with a base, a tough and a base. Yidleno, we'll draw it out. Okay. It's interesting, from that same pasuk of Naase Adam, we learn something else that also supports this idea of the purpose of asking advice. And that is the following. It says that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to that pasuk, Naase Adam, so he said to God, I can't write this. It appears from here that it's more than one God. It's plural. Let us make man. So you're giving a pishon peh, you're giving a place for the minim, the early Christians who believe in the Trinity, to, or anybody else who believed in more than one God, to support what they believe. So God said, you write, the harotza litos yitet. The person who wants to make a mistake will make a mistake. So on the surface, that doesn't make sense. God doesn't care if he makes people make mistakes. God commanded us, lifnei iver lo site nichshol. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Don't help somebody do a sin that without your help, don't cause people to do sins. And here God's causing people to sin. He's writing in the Torah something that appears to be questionable, that appears to say there's more than one God, giving these people strength in their argument that there's more than one God. And God doesn't care. I wrote, so whoever wants to make a mistake, let him make a mistake. It's not my business. That's, God just tells us not to function like that. Why does he function like that? So the Bali Musar say the following. No one ever became an apikoros because it says Nasa Adam. No first grader ever learned that sentence and said, I have to go join the parochial school down the block, right, and become a Catholic because it says, let us make man. Right? Why? Because the teacher explained what Rashi says there, like we said. God asked advice from the angels. Okay, no problem. And at the end of the sentence it says, Vayas Elokim Nasa Adam, in the singular. So you see it's not plural. Nobody in seventh grade, when you learn again, start learning again, Chumash, became an apikoros. No adult ever became an apikoros. You look at the Rashi and fine, finish, you go on. But apikoros and bring a proof from that. That's what God said. Not going to help. This is not going to cause people to make a mistake. But if a person wants to make a mistake, he'll make it from anywhere. You can distort anything. You see what you want to see. The exact same lesson of why we learn from there to ask advice, even from somebody of a lower stature, is because people are biased and they see what they want to see. And therefore God said, it's not going to help to change. I'd rather teach this lesson. Because somebody who wants to make a mistake is going to make a mistake no matter what. I used to stay when I was unmarried, Sukkot, when I was learning in Yeshiva in Cleveland, I used to stay in the home of a Rav in East Flatbush in New York for Sukkot. And he was the president for a while of the shul of Rabbi Avigdor Miller, who had a young Israel of rugby. And one Sukkot, this rabbi received a letter from a goy. And the goy believed that he himself, this goy, was Mashiach. And he wanted to convince the world he's Mashiach. This was before the internet. He couldn't just get on the internet and put out, you know, to everybody that I'm Mashiach. So he had a problem. How is he going to get to the world? Since he wasn't Mashiach, it was very hard to convince people he was. So he came upon a brilliant idea. He decided he's going to send letters to clergymen and convince them that he's Mashiach. And then with one letter, he can reach hundreds of people. Because he can tell the clergymen, now you convince your congregation that I'm Mashiach. If you're convinced, convince them. So with one letter, he could convince a few hundred people. So he wrote letters to priests, ministers, rabbis. This rabbi got one of these letters. The letter said, I saw the letter. I want to introduce myself. I am happy to tell you that I am the Messiah, and that I'm contacting you to prove to you, to convince you that I'm the Messiah, and I would like you to convince your congregation of that fact once you're convinced. And in order to convince you, I'm sending you 10 conclusive proofs that I am Messiah. I don't remember all the proofs, I remember one of them. The first one went something like this. It says in Yeshayahu that Mashiach will be l'malo mimalochim. He'll be above kings in English. He said, there's no doubt that Isaiah the prophet was talking about me. Why? Because in the apartment underneath me, there are two dogs named King, which puts me above kings. Now, you can't get more clear than that this is Vaday, guys, Mashiach. And all of the proofs were pretty much the same way. Harot, a person wants to make a mistake, can distort anything, convince himself of the most ridiculous things. Now, if you don't think it works like that in real life, I'll tell you a story. And even though the Nemtsovs are here, I'm going to hopefully not tell you enough information so they know who I'm talking about. I had a balabas who, to put it mildly, was a little eccentric. But since I had a lot of balabatim like that, they're not going to figure out which one of them it was. The guy was a little eccentric, to put it mildly. One day, he bursts into my office in Miami. He says, Rabbi, save my daughter. So I said, I'm not, you know, the Red Cross, and I'm not a doctor. How am I supposed to save your daughter? He said, I'll tell you. She's been going out with a yeshiva bacher. She was, at the time, maybe 18. She's going out, and she told me that this guy that she's going out with, if he proposes to her, she'll accept. She feels this is the one. Now, he says, I met this guy. He went on to describe this guy as a combination between Hitler, Mussolini, and Genghis Khan. This guy is the personification of evil, and if he marries my daughter, it's the end of her life, the end of our family, and probably the end of the world. So, Rabbi, you have to help me. She won't listen to me, which I understood, but she'll listen to you. You've got to convince her that this is not for her. I said, look, I said, you know, we both know that you're a little eccentric. So maybe your evaluation of this guy, I find it hard to believe that a guy sitting and learning yeshiva is as bad as you describe this guy. Maybe you're off base. So I want to make a deal with you. I am going to find a way of bumping into this guy and speaking to him, unbeknownst to him that this is on purpose. So he can't, you know, impress me. I'm just going to bump into him and strike up a conversation. If he's as bad as you say, I'm going to be lucky to get out of it with my life. If he's not as bad as you say, I want you to give me your word that you won't stand in the way of your daughter. You'll let her marry him if she wants. We shook hands on it. And that week, I found out where the yeshiva bachrim of this yeshiva eat lunch, in a pizza shop nearby. And I made it my business to be in that pizza shop at the same time. And I found out who the guy was, and I happened just to, by accident, sit down next to him and spend 45 minutes talking to him over lunch. Now, at the end of that session, I realized that the guy may not be as bad as the prospective father-in-law said, but this guy is off the wall. He is really nuts. Right? The guy was not normal. Okay, in 45 minutes of talking to him, I could see the guy is really something seriously psychologically wrong with him. And he surely wasn't for this girl. The girl's a nice, normal girl. So I figured, okay, I'm going to keep up my part of the bargain. It's going to be easy. I'm going to call the girl in, and she'll for sure listen to me. especially when I tell her all these terrible things that I see in 45 minutes, that the guy is really sick. Called her in, and I don't remember what the details were, what kind of things, but they were really serious things. So let's, for argument's sake, let's make it absurd. I told this girl, you know, I did a little research on this guy I hear you're going out with, and I found out that he's murdered 7 wives already. She looks at me, she says, I know, but he did it with such sensitivity. Are you out of your mind? I'm telling you the guy's a murderer. You're telling me he's sensitive? And everything I could say that in my mind was so negative, she twisted around and made it something positive. So I said to myself, you know what? Maybe it is a good shidduch. The girl's as crazy as he is. But I knew that she wasn't crazy. So what was the problem? She liked this guy. And I'll call Pshoyim Techasa Ava. A person's feelings color their vision and distort their vision. And everything that I saw objectively negative, she twisted because of her emotions, because of her feelings, to positive. Baruch Hashem, I didn't give up. And after a while, I wore her down, and she realized that this is not for her. So she called it off. She never got married with that guy. She got married to somebody else. So Baruch Hashem worked out very nicely. And this guy, Taka, had a very, very tragic life. Very tragic life. So I saved her from that. But in any case, so that's the way people are. If you want to make a mistake, you want to see things distorted, what you want is what you'll see. People see what they want to see, not necessarily what is true. Once had a bacher, very intelligent young man, and he was a smoker. So I wanted to convince him, stop smoking. I said, you know, it says on the cigarette pack that the Surgeon General has determined that cigarette smoking for sure causes terrible diseases. Aren't you afraid? Tells me no. He says, all of the scientific information that leads the Surgeon General to believe that it causes these terrible diseases was done on goyim who smoke 7 days a week. I only smoke 6 days a week. Doesn't apply to me. Absurd. But this guy was an intelligent guy, but he liked smoking. So this made sense to him. You see what you want to see. And therefore, when you are faced with an issue to make a decision, you need somebody to be able to advise you who is objective.
Did he listen to you?
No. In addition to that, because of this, sometimes you have to ask advice even if you don't have any choices. Even if you know for sure what you have to do, it's still good to ask advice, because how you do it and with what intention you do could change it from a mitzvah to an aveirah. Example I always like to give is, two people get up Shabbos morning, go to shul, daven, and listen to the Torah, and be yotze the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah. And one of them says, I hope the Baal Kori doesn't make any mistakes this week, because if he does, I'm going to have to correct him, because I really want to be yotze the mitzvah, but I'd rather, you know, that he doesn't make any mistakes and everything goes smoothly. The other guy gets up and says, oh wow, my enemy is the Baal Kori. I hope he makes a lot of mistakes, because I'm going to pounce on him and embarrass him publicly. They both go to shul, the Baal Kori gets up, and sure enough, he makes a mistake. Both of them pounce on him. One has a mitzvah, and one has an aveir. The first one is doing it with the intention of fulfilling the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah, and he has no choice, but he has to correct the Baal Kori. The second guy is gleefully embarrassing this guy publicly and using Kriyas HaTorah as an excuse. He's going to get a punishment for it. No child. Huh? Right. So therefore, how not only what you do is significant, how you do it, what do you think about? So it's good to ask advice even when you know that you have no choices. It's not a question of asking advice what to do, but with what intention also makes a difference. And it could change things from day to night. One more point. And that point is that who you ask advice from. The Gemara says, be careful of someone who gives you advice al pi darko, according to his way. Now some learn that that means that he gives you bad advice because it's good for him and bad for you. Right? You go to somebody and ask him, you think you're selling your house, and you want to know if you think it's a good idea. Meanwhile, this guy's always wanted your house, right? And he has a secret agenda. Really, it's the worst thing to sell your house right now. The market is terrible, and you won't get a lot of money. But for him, it's great. You won't be able to get a good price. He wants the house. He'll get it for a cheap thing, so he gives you advice. Good idea to sell your house. And then he gets somebody to buy it for him. So that somebody gives you advice, bad advice, for his purposes. But that's not what it's talking about. That's a person who gives you bad advice. This is talking about something else. If you come to me for advice, I can approach it in one of two ways. I can say, if I had that problem, what would I do? If I say that, I am totally unfit to give you advice. Because what I would do is irrelevant, because I have my bias. So I'm substituting my bias for your bias. If I'm thinking of what I would do in such a similar situation, first of all, I don't have the same situation as you. I don't have the same conditions as you, right? So maybe I would have to do something completely different because of my circumstances than you would have to do. So if I'm looking at it from my standpoint, and also from my standpoint, I have my own bias and subjectivity. So basically what you're getting is an answer that's based on my circumstances and my subjectivity, and not going to help you at all. What I have to do is say the following. If I would be you, with your circumstances, without your subjectivity and bias, what would I do? That's how I have to project myself into your situation, but without your bias. Then I can give you advice. If I can't do that, then I can't give you advice. And therefore, that explains a very difficult medrash. The medrash says that Nadav and Avihu both came to the conclusion independently that they should go bring that fire into the Holy of Holies, for which they were killed. One of the Midrashim says that why they were guilty was because they didn't ask advice from each other. It also says they didn't ask advice from Moshe, they didn't ask advice from their father Aaron. That I understand. Had they asked Moshe or Aaron, they would have told them, don't do it. But each one independently decided to do this. What would have helped if Nadav said to Avihu, I get this great idea of bringing fire into the Holy Holies, and Avihu was there, I got the same idea. What would have helped if they asked each other advice? Both of them independently decided to do it. Well, the answer is they were great people. And if Nadav had come to Avihu and said, I have this great idea about bringing fire into the Holy of Holies, what do you think? Avihu would have said, let me project myself into Nadav's shoes, without his bias, and see if this is good or not. He would see right away it's no good. When he thought about it for himself, he was biased. So he saw it distorted. Had he been able to free himself of his bias and put himself in the other one's shoes, he would have surely seen that it was no good, and vice versa. Had they asked each other advice, they would have not done it. It's only because they looked at it only from their own standpoint that they ended up doing the sin. So therefore, possible to ask somebody advice if they can put themselves in your shoes, not put you in their shoes. And that's not easy. Not everybody can do that. Only somebody who can really relate and empathize with somebody else can reach that level. That takes a great person. Not every person can do that. You don't have to be a great genius to do that. But you have to be a sensitive person. So that is what Avraham Avinu said. Avraham Avinu said, God gave me this mitzvah. It's a mitzvah I can only do once. I want to do it and know that my feelings are... I'm not going to ask if I should do it or not. Of course I'm doing it. The question is, I want to hear an objective opinion from somebody who can identify with this idea of making a bris with God. What does that mean? In addition, some of the Mepharshim say that Avraham Avinu had a dilemma, because until now his purpose in life was to influence other people. He felt that he could influence other people better if he's like them. But if he's going to have a bris milah different than other people, then maybe he's not going to be able to influence anymore. They'll look at him as something separate from them, that can't have a connection to them anymore. And therefore, he felt, maybe I should do this bris, but I should do it privately. Nobody should know. On the other hand, maybe I should do it publicly and people should know that I have this connection to God. So he went to ask people who he felt could put themselves into his position in this issue. Who was that? Baalei bris, Avraham. the people who had a covenant with him, they had an experience with covenants. So he didn't ask Shem and Aver, he didn't ask Eliezer, because he didn't feel that they could relate to this. But these three people could relate to it. I want to know how they look at this from their objective standpoint, if they could put themselves in my shoes. So Onner said, you know, if God gave me this mitzvah, I would consider it like it's suicide. God wants me to commit suicide. Because I'm 99 years old, there's no way in the world I'm going to survive this. So if you're committing suicide, don't be too much worried about it. That's what the mitzvah is. Then do it, and do it, you know, to commit suicide. Avraham Avinu said, that's no advice, because you're not me. God gave you the mitzvah. Don't tell me what you would do, right? Tell me what I would do if you were me, not if I were you. So he left. Went to Eshkol, and Eshkol said, you know, they're going to take revenge. Even if you survive this, if they find out about this publicly, they're going to take revenge on you. The people that you killed, their relatives. So same thing. God probably wants you to put yourself in danger, get killed, and you're sacrificing your life for God's sake, just like later on you want to sacrifice your son, now he wants you to sacrifice yourself. And Avraham says the same thing. You're putting me in your situation, not the opposite. Finally came to Mamre. What did Mamre say? If I was you, and God saved me from the Kibshon HaEsh, and he saved me from the four kings, you obviously live a charmed life. God does miracles for you. So if I was you, I wouldn't have this problem. Obviously, God's going to make sure that you don't lose anything out by this. So do it and have in mind that you're doing it and you're not going to, you're still going to be able to influence people. Onner and Eshkol didn't give him bad advice. They didn't give him any advice. They couldn't free themselves of their bias and look at it from their perspective. That's not advice. Only Mamre could free himself of his bias and look at it from Avraham Avinu's eyes without Avraham Avinu's bias and give him good advice. Why was the reward that God appeared in his place? Because like we said, if you don't want to see God because your bias says you don't want to be subjugated to a God, then you'll look at the world and you'll see random chance, evolution, and you won't see an intelligent God. But if you free yourself of your subjectivity and you're objective, then you'll see God. Only objective people can really believe in God. Because subjective people who don't want to believe in God, nothing's going to convince them. They're not going to believe in God. If you're objective, you look at an orderly world and assume, just like this tape recorder probably came because somebody who knows how to make tape recorders made it, right? And dictionaries were written by people who know how to write dictionaries, that the world was created by an intelligent creator who put together this complex world. But if you don't want to believe in God, then you will believe in the most fantastic things, which is, takes more belief to believe in evolution than to believe in God. Believing in God takes one leap of faith. You believe that there's a superior being. But if you believe in evolution, that means you believe that there's nothing outside the system and everything happened accidentally. So first you have to believe that there was something there to begin with that we don't know where it came from. And it's not the same question about God. Where did God come from? He didn't come from anywhere. He always was there. That's the definition of God. But if you don't accept a God, and you only accept what's in the system of nature, in nature, things don't just aren't there all the time. They have to be made, and they can't make themselves. So you have to start with hydrogen atoms and space. Where did that come from? I don't know. I believe it was there. That's like the free space on the bingo card. You have to start with something. Okay, now you have hydrogen atoms and space. So now you can already start a process. By accident, the hydrogen atoms imploded, fission, and they formed all the elements of the periodic table. Now you have all the elements floating around in space. Millions and millions of years later, you have stars, and some of the stars come close to each other and pull off planets, and there's one solar system where some material is pulled from one star, sent it around the other star, and some of those planets were too close to support life, they're too hot, some of them were too far, too cold to support life, and one, just by accident, was just right, like Goldilocks' porridge, right in the middle, not too hot, not too cold, can support water, air. And then, millions of years later, all of the building blocks of life, the amino acids and the proteins were just floating around in the seas, waiting to be made into an amoeba, into life. Now, scientists can't do that on purpose. They put all these chemicals in a test tube, pass current through it, right, rain dance around it, whatever they want to do, and they have never been able to take non-living things, all of the components of life, and make it into living. On purpose, they can't do it, but it happened by accident. So by accident, there was just a lightning bolt, and then from all this soup of materials came an amoeba. Okay, the amoeba was very happy being an amoeba, didn't know it'd be anything else. But one day, the amoeba, instead of having another amoeba, right, had a mutant, a many-celled animal. Now, that is more impossible than the following. The following is much more possible. Woman goes to have a baby. The doctor comes in. He says, Mazel tov, it's a giraffe. The woman says, I wasn't exactly expecting a giraffe. Is it a boy giraffe or a girl giraffe? But a giraffe? He said, yeah. You know, sometimes people have mutants. You had a giraffe. It's possible. Those are both mammals. But for an amoeba to have a paramecium is much more difficult. But it happens. Usually mutants are negative. But there you have to believe that then it was positive. Okay. Millions and millions of years later, the paramecians had mutants also until you have fish. Now, these fish just came about by accident. But they were wise and prophetic fish. Because somehow the fish knew that a million years in the future, the rivers were going to dry up, and they needed to create mutants of children that had lungs. Because otherwise they'd drown in the air if they only had gills. They had to know this a million years in advance to start getting the process going. How did they know that? Maybe they felt the water going out the drain. I don't know exactly how they knew it, but they were prophetic and wise accidental fish. And somehow, millions and millions of years later, sure enough, the rivers were drying up, and the amphibians went out and were able to, and then they found food, which was evolving at the same time, because they knew that the amphibians were coming, so the plants had to evolve too. So there'd be few food, so they wouldn't die within 3 days of malnutrition. And all this is happening just by accident. Big accident. Okay, now some of the amphibians decide it's too hard to walk, they become birds, some of them become reptiles, finally some become mammals, and the mammals evolve to apes, and one day an ape opens the New York Times and becomes a human being. And that's how human beings got here. Right? For somebody to believe that, it takes more than just a leap of faith. It takes a lot of belief. Scientists say that evolution is a bigger religion, a bigger belief than people believe in God. But the people, intelligent, respected people who believe this, who make it scientific, and who laugh at people believing in a God, that's fairy tales. Harotza litoshita. If you want to believe in God, then there's what to see objectively. There's no proof. You can never prove there's a God. Because if you could, there's no bechira, there's no pre-choice. There's always a place to make a mistake. Always a place to believe otherwise. But if you want to believe, there's plenty of proof to support your belief. But if you don't want to believe, there's plenty you can make a mistake. So who can see God? Somebody who can be objective. If you're going to be subjective, you're not going to see God. If you don't want to see God, you're not going to see Him. Only somebody like Mamre, who could be objective, could be the place where God appears in this world. That's why God appeared in Mamre's thing. Just to end, today, terrible tragedy, Nosson Tzvi Finkel was Nifta, Rosh Yeshiva of Mir. In the last few days, many, many Rosh Hashivas, Beryl Schwartzman was Nifter or whatever, but Nosson Tzvi, I know a little bit because my son-in-law is part of the family. His mother is a Finkel. And Nosson Tzvi was an enigma. I mean, if you ever saw him, he had Parkinson's disease. He looked like he couldn't function normally at all. Yet, he ran this yeshiva Mir, the biggest yeshiva in the world. He raised the funds. I shudder to think I have to raise, you know, so a little bit of money for my yeshiva. Right? He had to raise millions of dollars, just not every year, every month, to keep it going. So you think, okay, it's a fundraiser. No, he gave shiurim all over, even though he needed people to hold his hand so they didn't shake and then hold him up. He knew every bacher in the yeshiva person. He was a Baal Eitzah. Because he was this kind of person that could relate objectively to other people, to be able to put himself in other people's, that's a godel. An Adam godel is a person who's not just from his head to his toes, but a person who feels that he's connected to everybody else. And the more people you're connected with, the greater a person you are. So the world lost a very, very special person. I don't know the Rabbanu Shmuel Rachmanis on who's going to have to take over the responsibility of supporting Nir Yeshiva. Right, the thousands of bachurim, the biggest yeshiva that I think ever existed. And who's going to be able to do all the things that he did? You need like three or four different people to full-time jobs to do it all. So, but that's the idea. The idea is that a great person can give advice. That's why you go to great people for advice. Not because they're smarter than everybody else, because they're able to free themselves of their bias. They're able to relate to other people and put themselves in their shoes and understand their circumstances, not just themselves. And in that way, they can give advice. That's the kind of person that you go for advice for. And that's the reason why people go to Anoshim Gedolim for advice, because they can give that kind of advice that we just spoke about.